Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today, we're with you to bring you the last of the Hector Human Row Complete Stories of Saki. Now, the book I have, a very tiny type, runs just about 600 pages exactly, and I had thought it was all short stories, but the last three are called novels, even though they're shorter, and I suppose I'll do them too, but for today we're going to do five instead of the usual four stories, and we'll just round out the end of the last stories before moving on to the novels, which are really only novella length at most, that is 60, 70 pages. So, as I said, these will be five stories, and they're actually, if anything, shorter than the normal four that we've been doing. So, let's dig in. First story up is called The Infernal Parliament. The Infernal, as in hellish, Parliament. In an age when it has become increasingly difficult to accomplish anything new or original, Bavton Biverdale, and boy, you have to look closely at his names because they're always bizarre, interested his generation by dying of a new disease. "We always knew he would do something remarkable one of these days," observed his aunts. "He has justified our belief in him." Difficult to do anything new or original, so this guy dies of a new disease. But there is a section of humanity ever ready to refuse recognition to meritorious achievement, and a large and influential school of doctors asserted their belief that Biverdale was not really dead. The funeral arrangements had to be held over until the matter was settled one way or another, and the aunts went provisionally into half mourning. Meanwhile, Biverdale remained in hell as a guest pending his reception on a more regular footing. "If you were not really supposed to be dead," said the authorities of that region, again the name of the infernal parliament, hence hell. "If you were not really supposed to be dead," said the authorities of that region, the devil, etc., "we don't want to seem in an indecent hurry to grab you." The theory that hell is in serious need of population is a thing of the past. "Why, to take your family alone, there are any number of Biverdales on our books, as you may discover later. It is part of our system that relations should be encouraged to live together down here. From observations made in another world, we have abundant evidence that it promotes the ends we have in view. However, while you are a guest, we should like you to be treated with every consideration and be shown anything that specially interests you. Of course, you would like to see our parliament?" "Have you a parliament in hell?" said Biverdale in some surprise. "Only quite recently. Of course, we've always had chaos, but not under parliamentary rules. Now, however, parliaments are becoming the fashion in Turkey and Persia, and I suppose before long in Afghanistan and China. It seemed rather ostentatious to stand outside the movement. That young fiend just going by is the member for East Brimstone. He'll be delighted to show you over the institution." "You will be just in time to hear the opening of a debate," said the member, as he led Biverdale through a spacious outer lobby decorated with frescoes representing the fall of man, the discovery of gold, the invention of playing cards, and other traditionally appropriate subjects for the Parliament of Hell. The member for Nether Furnace is proposing a motion, quote, "that this House do arrogantly protest to the legislatures of earthly countries against the wrongful and injurious misuse of the word fiendish in application of purely human misendeavors, human misdemeanors, a misuse tending to create a false and detrimental impression concerning the infernal regions," close quote. This is very Mark Twainish, and I would not be surprised if inspired by some of Twain's writings. That's the paragraph along the lines of what he would think if he expressed it slightly differently. But even there, it's similar. A feature of the Parliament chamber itself was its enormous size. The space allotted to members was small and very sparsely occupied, but the public galleries stretched away tier on tier as far as the eye could reach and were packed to their utmost capacity. "There seems to be a very great public interest in the debate," exclaimed Bitterdale. "Members are excused from attending the debates if they so desire," the Fiend proceeded to explain. "It is one of their most highly valued privileges. On the other hand, constituents are compelled to listen throughout to all the speeches. After all, you must remember, we are in hell." Bitterdale repressed a shudder and turned his attention to the debate. "Nothing," the Fiend Orator was observing, "is more deplorable among the cultured races of the present day than the tendency to identify fiendhood in the most sweeping fashion with all manner of disreputable excesses, excesses which can only be alleged against us on the merest legendary evidence. Vices which are exclusively or predominantly human are unblushingly described as inhuman, and what is even more contemptible and ungenerous, as fiendish." So they want the return of their good name or their bad name, as it were. If one investigates such statements as, quote, "inhuman treatment of pit ponies," or "fiendish cruelties in the Congo," so frequently to be heard in our brother parliaments on Earth, one finds accumulative and indisputable evidence that it is the human treatment of pit ponies and Congo natives that is really in question, and that no authenticated case of fiendish agency in these atrocities can be substantiated. "It is perhaps a minor matter for complaint," continued the orator, "that the human race frequently pays us the doubtful compliment of describing as, quote, devilish funny, unquote, jokes which are neither funny nor devilish." The orator paused, and an oppressive silence reigned over the vast chamber. "What is happening?" whispered Bitterdale. 5 minutes hush," explained his guide. "It is a sign that the speaker was listened to in silent approval, which is the highest mark of appreciation that can be bestowed in pandemonium, capital P. Let's come into the smoking room." "Will the motion be carried?" asked Bitterdale, wondering inwardly how Sir Edward Grey would treat the protest if it reached the British Parliament and, entente with the infernal regions, opened up a fascinating vista in which the Foreign Secretary's imagination might hopelessly lose itself. "Carried? Of course not," said the Fiend. "In the infernal Parliament, all motions are necessarily lost." "In earthly parliaments nowadays, nearly everything is found," said Bitterdale, "including salaries and traveling expenses." He felt that, at any rate, he was probably the first member of his family to make a joke in hell. "By the way," he added, "talking of earthly parliaments, have you got the party system down here?" "In hell? Impossible. You see, we have no system of rewards. We have specialized so thoroughly on punishments that the other branch has been entirely neglected. And besides, government by delusion, as you practice it in your parliament, would be unworkable here. I should be the last person to say anything against temptation, naturally, but we have a proverb down here, quote, 'In baiting a mousetrap with cheese, always leave room for the mouse.' Such a party cry, for instance, as your, quote, 9 pence for 4 pence, would be absolutely inoperative. It not only leaves no room for the mouse, it leaves no room for the imagination. You have a saying in your country, I believe, 'There's no fool like a damned fool.' All the fools down here are necessarily damned, but you wouldn't get them to nibble at a 9 pence for 4 pence. Couldn't they be scolded and lectured into believing it as a sort of moral and intellectual duty?" asked Bitterdale. "We haven't all your facilities," said the Fiend. "We've nothing down here that exactly corresponds to the master of Ellabank." I have zero idea what that is an allusion to. Excuse me. At this moment, Bitterdale's attention was caught by an item on a loose sheet of agenda paper. "Vote on account of special hells." "Ah," he said, "I've often heard of the expression, 'There is a special hell reserved for such and such a type of person.' Do tell me about them." I'll show you one in course of preparation, said the fiend, leading him down the corridor. This one is designed to accommodate one of the leading playwrights of your nation. You may observe scores of imps engaged in pasting notices of modern British plays into a huge press-cutting book, each under the name of the author, alphabetically arranged. The book will contain nearly 500,000 notices, I suppose, and it will form the sole literature supplied to this specially doomed individual. Bitterdale was not altogether impressed. Some dramatic authors wouldn't so very much mind spending eternity poring over a book of contemporary press cuttings, he observed. The fiend, laughing unpleasantly, lowered his voice. The letter S is missing. For the first time, Bitterdale realized that he was in hell. I suppose now the question is, what is that? It must be a reference to Shaw. I don't know what any other playwright possibly of enough stature to be mocked in this way. So Shaw would have to read, a special hell would be reserved for George Bernard Shaw, who would have to read the press clippings of every playwright but himself. I guess that's what the joke is there. Okay, moving on to number two, the achievement of the cat. The achievement of the cat. The achievement of the cat. C-A-T. Nailed it! In the political history of nations, it is no uncommon experience to find states and peoples which, but a short time since, were in bitter conflict and animosity with each other, settled down comfortably on terms of mutual goodwill and even alliance. The natural history of the social developments of species affords a similar instance in the coming together of two once warring elements, now represented by civilized man and the domestic cat. The fiercely waged struggle which went on between humans and felines in those far-off days when saber-toothed tiger and cave lion contended with primeval man has long ago been decided in favor of the most fitly equipped combatant, the thing with a thumb. And the descendants of the dispossessed family are relegated today, for the most part, to the wastelands of jungle and veld, where an existence of self-effacement is the only alternative to extermination. Self-effacement would be a writer's term for hiding. But the Felis catus, or whatever species was the ancestor of the modern domestic cat, a vexed question at present, by a masterstroke of adaptation, avoided the ruin of its race and captured a place in the very keystone of the conqueror's organization. For not as a bondservant or dependent has this proudest of mammals entered the human fraternity, not as a slave like the beast of burden or beasts of burden or a humble camp follower like the dog. The cat is domestic only as far as suits its own end. It will not be kenneled or harnessed nor suffer any dictation as to its goings out or comings in. Long contact with the human race has developed in it the art of diplomacy, and no Roman cardinal of medieval days knew better how to ingratiate himself with his surroundings than a cat with a saucer of cream on its mental horizon. But the social smoothness, the purring innocence, the softness of the velvet paw may be laid aside at a moment's notice, and the sinuous feline may disappear in deliberate aloofness to a world of roofs and chimney stacks where the human element is distanced and disregarded, or the innate savage spirit that helped its survival in the bygone days of tooth and claw may be summoned forth from beneath the sleek exterior, and the torture instinct, common alone to human and feline, may find free play in the death throes of some luckless bird or rodent. It is indeed no small triumph to have combined the untrammeled liberty of primeval savagery with the luxury which only a highly developed civilization can command. To be lapped in the soft stuffs that commerce has gathered from the far ends of the world, to bask in the warmth that labor and industry have dragged from the bowels of the earth, to banquet on the dainties that wealth has bespoken for its table, and withal to be a free son of nature, a mighty hunter, a spiller of lifeblood. This is the victory of the cat. But besides the credit of success, the cat has other qualities which compel recognition. The animal which the Egyptians worshipped as divine, which the Romans venerated as a symbol of liberty, which the Europeans in the ignorance of the Middle Ages anathematized as an agent of demonology, has displayed to all ages two closely blended characteristics, courage and self-respect. No matter how unfavorable the circumstances, both qualities are always to the fore. Confront a child, a puppy, and a kitten with a sudden danger. The child will turn instinctively for assistance. The puppy will grovel in abject submission to the impending visitation. The kitten will brace its tiny body for a frantic resistance. And disassociate the luxury-loving cat from the atmosphere of social comfort in which it usually contrives to move, and observe it critically under the adverse conditions of civilization, that civilization which can impel a man to the degradation of clothing himself in tawdry, ribald garments and capering mountebank dances in the streets for the earning of the few coins that can keep him on the respectable or non-criminal side of society, the cat of the slums and alleys, starved, outcast, harried, still keeps amid the prowlings of its adversity the bold, free, panther tread with which it paced of yore the temple courts of Thebes, still displays the self-reliant watchfulness which man has never taught it to lay aside. And when its shifts and clever managings have not sufficed to stave off inexorable fate, when its enemies have proved too strong or too many for its defensive powers, it dies, fighting to the last, quivering with the choking rage of mastered resistance, and voicing in its death yell that agony of its bitter remonstrance which human animals, too, have flung at the powers that may be, the last protest against a destiny that might have made them happy and has not. So that would be some praise for the cat, the achievement of the cat, that was. Like I said, these are a little shorter. We've got three left, but only a couple pages. The old town of Pskov, P-S-K-O-F-F. The old town of Pskov. Russia, at the present crisis of its history, and not unnaturally, suggests to the foreign mind a land pervaded with discontent and disorder and weighed down with depression. And it is certainly difficult to point to any quarter of the imperial dominions from which troubles of one sort or another are not reported. Remember, this is probably written around the time of the communists, or even after their revolution. In the Novo Vremya and other papers, a column is now devoted to the chronicling of disorders as regularly as a British news sheet reports sporting events. It is the more agreeable, therefore, occasionally to make the acquaintance of another phase of Russian life where the somberness of political mischance can be momentarily lost sight of or disbelieved in. Perhaps there are a few spots in European Russia where, that would be on this side of the Urals, where one so thoroughly feels that one has passed into a new and unfamiliar atmosphere as the town of Pskov, P-S-K-O-F-F. Once in its day, a very important center of Russian life. To the average modern Russian, a desire to visit Pskov is an inexplicable mental freak on the part of a foreigner who wishes to see something of the country he is living in. Petersburg, Moscow, Kiev, perhaps Nizhny Novgorod, or the Finnish watering places if you want a country holiday, but why Pskov? And thus, happily, an aversion to beaten tracks in localities where inspection is invited and industriously cared for returns one towards the old great Russian border town, which probably gives as accurate a picture as can be obtained of a medieval Russian burg, untouched by Mongol influence, and only slightly affected by Byzantine imported culture. The little town has ample charm of situation and structure, standing astride of a bold scarp of land wedged into the fork of two rivers and retaining yet much of the long lines of ramparts and towers that serve for many a hundred years to keep out pagan Lithuanians and marauding Teuton knights. The powers of darkness were as carefully guarded against in those old days as more tangible human enemies, and from out of thick clusters of treetops there still arise the white walls and green roofs of many churches, monasteries, and bell towers, quaint and fantastic in architecture, and delightfully harmonious in coloring. Steep, winding streets lead down from the rampart-girt heart of the town to those parts which lie along the shores of the twin rivers, and two bridges, one a low, wide wooden structure, were primitively planted on piles, giving access to the further banks, where more towers and monasteries, with other humbler buildings, continue the outstrangling span of the township. On the rivers lie barges with high masts painted in wonderful bands of scarlet, green, white, and blue, topped with gilded wooden pennons, figured somewhat like a child's rattle, and fluttering strips of bunting at their ends. Up in the town, one sees on all sides quaint old doorways, deep archways, wooden gable ends, railed staircases, and a crowning touch of pleasing color in the sage green or dull red of the roofs. But it is strangest of all to find a human population in complete picturesque harmony with its rich old-world setting. The scarlet or blue blouses that are worn by the working men in most Russian towns give way here to a variety of gorgeous tinted garments, and the womenfolk are similarly gay in their apparel, so that streets and wharves and the marketplace glow with wonderfully effective groupings of color. Mulberry, orange, dull carmine, faded rose, hyacinth purple, greens and lilacs and rich blues mingle their hues on shirts and shawls, skirts and breeches and waistbands. Nature, competing with Percy Anderson, was the frivolous comment that came to one's mind, and certainly a medieval crowd could scarcely have been more effectively staged. And the business of a town in which it seemed always market day went forward with an air of contented absorption on the part of the inhabitants. Strings of primitively fashioned carts went to and from the riverside, the horses wearing their bits for the most part hung negligently under the chin, a fashion that prevails in many parts of Russia and Poland. Bits under the chin, I guess as opposed to in the mouth. Quaint little booths line the side of some of the steeper streets, and here wooden toys and earthenware pottery of strange local patterns are set out for sale. On the broad marketplace, women sit gossiping by the side of large baskets of strawberries. One or two long-legged foals sprawl at full stretch under the shade of their parental market carts, and an extremely contented pig pursues his leisurely way under the guardianship of an elderly dame robed in a scheme of orange, mulberry, and white that would delight the soul of a colorist. A stalwart peasant strides across the uneven cobbles, leading his plow horse and carrying on his shoulder a small wooden plow with iron-tipped shares that must date back to some stage of agriculture that the West has long left behind. Down in the buoyant waters of the Velikaya, the larger of the two rivers, youths and men are disporting themselves, and stater washerwomen are rinsing and smacking piles of many-hued garments. It is pleasant to swim well out into the stream of the river and, with one's chin on a level with a wide stretch of water, take in a trout's eye view of the little town, ascending in tiers of wharfage, trees, gray ramparts, more trees, and clustered roofs, with the old cathedral of the Trinity poised guardian-like above the crumbling walls of the Kremlin. The cathedral, on closer inspection, is a charming specimen of genuine old Russian architecture, full of rich carvings and aglow with scarlet pigment and gilded scrollwork, and stored with yet older relics or pseudo-relics of local hero saints, hyphenated hero saints, and hero princes who helped in their day to make the history of the Pskov Commonwealth. After an hour or two spent among these tombs and icons and memorials of dead Russia, one feels that some time must elapse before one cares to enter again the drearily magnificent holy places of St. Petersburg, with their depressing nouveau riche atmosphere, their priceless tongued attendance, and general lack of historic interest. The heart knoweth its own bitterness, and maybe the Peskovsky, amid their seeming contentment and self-absorption, have their own hungerings for a new and happier era of national life. But the stranger does not ask to see so far. He is thankful to have found a picturesque and apparently well-contented corner of a weary land, a land, quote, where distress seems like a bird of passage that has hurt its wing and cannot fly away. So there's a bit of travel writing, I guess you'd have to call that, about Peskov. Next, Clovis on the alleged romance of business. Clovis. Had a whole section on Clovis, didn't we? Now, let's see. Clovis on the alleged romance of business. It is the fashion nowadays, said Clovis, to talk about the romance of business. There isn't any such thing. The romance has been all the other way, with the idle apprentice, the truant, the runaway, the individual who couldn't be bothered with figures and bookkeeping and left business to look after itself. I admit that a grocer's shop is one of the most romantic and thrilling things that I have ever happened on, but the romance and thrill are centered in the groceries, not the grocer. The citron and spices and nuts and dates, the barreled anchovies and Dutch cheeses, the jars of caviar, and the chests of tea, they carry the mind away to Levantine coasts and tropic shores, to the old world wharfs and quays of the Low Countries, to dusty Atrachan and far Cathay, it's a name for India. If the grocer's apprentice has any romance in him, it is not a business education he gets behind the grocer's counter. It is a standing invitation to dream and to wander and to remain poor. As a child, such places as South America and Asia Minor were brought painstakingly under my notice. The names of their principal rivers and the heights of their chief mountain peaks were committed to my memory, and I was earnestly enjoined to consider them as parts of the world that I lived in. It was only when I visited a large, well-stocked grocer's shop that I realized that they certainly existed. And again, notice his use of the word there. Unusual and effective use of the word certainly. A very common word as we use it, but look how he's used it. I'll intone it again. I didn't intone it incorrectly, but let's appreciate it fully. He says, so he is a kid. I had to study all this in geography class, to paraphrase what he said. Semicolon, his favorite. His favorite device is the semicolon. It was only when I visited a large, well-stocked grocer shop that I realized that they certainly existed. We would have put that same thing a different way, but the way he does it is perfectly valid and something you could use or I could use when writing. It's how we learn, how we expand. It's not so much the vocabulary you have, that's part of it, but it's not the bigger part of it. The bigger part of it is knowing how to use the words in the different ways, even meaning this exact same meaning, but using them in slightly different ways and using the right words when to achieve your effect. Now, such galleries of romance and fascination are not bequeathed to us by the businessman. He is only the dull custodian who talks glibly of Spanish olives and Rangoon rice, a Spain that he has never known or wished to know, a Rangoon that he has never imagined or could imagine. It was the unledgered wanderer, the careless-hearted seafarer, the aimless outcast who opened up new trade routes, tapped new markets, brought home samples or cargoes of new edibles and unknown condiments. It was they who brought the glamour and romance to the threshold of business life, where it was promptly reduced to pounds, shillings, and pence, invoiced, double-entry, quoted, written off, and so forth. Most of those terms are probably wrong, but a little inaccuracy sometimes saves tons of explanation. So that's like H.S. Thompson. My concern for facts is not at the nickel and dime level. He's trying to get at the deeper truth. And that's a very dangerous thing, but there is a need for both. But this is akin to what he's saying here. On the other side of the account, there is the industrious apprentice who grew up into the businessman, married early and worked late, and lived, thousands and thousands of him, in little villas outside big towns. He is buried by the thousand in Kensal Green and other large cemeteries. Any romance that was ever in him was buried prematurely in shop and warehouse and office. Whenever I feel in the least tempted to be businesslike or methodical or even decently industrious, I go to Kensal Green and look at the graves of those who died in business. So, maybe a more of an artist point of view or a romantic's point of view. Finally, the last story in this collection. It's called The Comments of Mong Ka. The Comments of Mong Ka, M-O-U-N-G, new word, K-A, something Chinese, I suppose. The Comments of Mong Ka, or Asian in some way. Mong Ka, cultivator of rice and philosophic virtues, sat on the raised platform of his cane-built house by the banks of the swiftly flowing Irrawaddy. On two sides of the house, there was a bright green swamp, which stretched away to where the uncultivated jungle growth began. In the bright green swamp, which was really a rice field when you looked closely at it, bitterns and pond herons and elegant cattle egrets stalked and peered with the absorbed air of careful and conscientious reptile hunters, who could never forget that, while they were undoubtedly useful, they were also distinctly decorative. So the egret in the field knows the aesthetic role it is playing, as well as searching for its prey. In the tall reed growth by the riverside, grazing buffaloes showed in patches of dark slaty blue, like palms fallen amid long grass, and in the tamarind trees that shaded Mong Ka's house, the crows, restless, raucous-throated, and much too many, kept up their incessant afternoon din, saying over and over again all the things that crows have said since there were crows to say them. Mong Ka sat smoking his enormous green-brown cigar, without which no Burmese man, Burma, now Myanmar, without his green-brown cigar, no Burmese man, woman, or child seems really complete, dispensing from time to time installments of worldly information for the benefit and instruction of his two companions. The steamer which came up river from Mandalay thrice a week and brought Mong Ka a Rangoon news sheet, in which the progress of the world's event was set forth in telegraphic messages and commented on in pithy paragraphs. Mong Ka, who read these things and retailed them as an occasion, served to his friends and neighbors with philosophical additions of his own, was held in some esteem locally as a political thinker. In Burma, it is possible to be a politician without ceasing to be a philosopher. His friend, Mong Thwa, T-H-W-A, dealer in teakwood, had just returned downriver from distant Bhamo, B-H-A-M-O, where he had spent many weeks in dignified, unhurried chaffering with the Chinese merchants, the first place to which he had naturally turned his steps, bearing with him his betel box, betel nuts, and fat cigar had been the raised platform of Mong Ka's cane-built house under the tamarind trees. Betel is B-E-T-L, they're nuts. The youthful Mong Shugale, so a third Mong, Mong Ka, Mong Shugale, and Mong, what was the other one? Mong Thwa, the teakwood dealer. The youthful Mong Shugale, who had studied in the foreign schools at Mandalay and knew many English words, was also of the little group that sat listening to Mong Ka's bulletin of the world's health and ignoring the screeching of the crows. There had been the usual preliminary talk of timber and the rice market and sundry local matters, and then the wider and remoter things of life came under review. And what has been happening away from here? Asked Meng Thua, the newspaper reader. Away from here comprised that considerable portion of the world's surface which lay beyond the village boundaries. Many things, said Meng Ka reflectively, but principally two things of much interest and of an opposite nature. Both, however, concern the action of governments. Meng Thua nodded his head gravely with the air of one who reverenced and distrusted all governments. The first thing, of which you may have heard on your journeyings, said Meng Ka, is an act of the Indian government, which has annulled the not long ago accomplished partition of Bengal. Bengal, Cathay, old names for India. I heard something of this, said Meng Thua, from a Madrasi merchant on the boat journey. But I did not learn of the reasons that made the government take this step. Why was the partition annulled? Because, said Meng Ka, it was held to be against the wishes of the greater number of the people of Bengal. Therefore, the government made an end of it. Meng Thua was silent for a moment. Is it a wise thing the government has done? He asked presently. It may be a good thing. It is a good thing to consider the wishes of a people, said Meng Ka. The Bengalis may be a people who do not always wish what is best for them. Who can say? But at least their wishes have been taken into consideration, and that is a good thing. And the other matter of which you spoke? Questioned Meng Thua, the matter of an opposite nature. The other matter, said Meng Ka, is that the British government has decided on the partition of Britain. Where there has been one parliament and one government, there are to be two parliaments and two governments, and there will be two treasuries and two sets of taxes. Meng Thua was greatly interested in this news. And is the feeling of the people of Britain in favor of this partition? He asked. Will they not dislike it as the people of Bengal dislike the partition of their province? The feeling of the people of Britain has not been consulted and will not be consulted, said Meng Ka. The act of partition will pass through one chamber where the government rules supreme, and the other chamber can only delay it a little while and then it will be made into the law of the land. But is it not wise to consult the feeling of the people? Asked Meng Thua. Very wise, answered Meng Ka, for if the people were consulted, they would say no, as they have always said when such a decree was submitted to their opinion. And if the people said no, there would be an end of the matter, but also an end of the government. Therefore, it is wise for the government to shut its ears to what the people may wish. But why must the people of Bengal be listened to and the people of Britain not listened to? And again, this is 100 years before now, asked Meng Thua. Surely the partition of their country affects them just as closely. Are their opinions too silly to be of any weight? The people of Britain are what is called a democracy, said Meng Ka. A democracy? Questioned Meng Thua. What is that? A democracy, broke in Meng Shugale eagerly, is a community that governs itself according to its own wishes and interests by electing accredited representatives who enact its laws and supervise and control their administration. Its aim and object is government of the community in the interests of the community. Then, said Meng Thua, turning to his neighbor, if the people of Britain are a democracy, I never said they were a democracy. Interrupted Meng Ka placidly. Surely we heard you, exclaimed Meng Thua. Not correctly, said Meng Ka. I said they are what is called a democracy. And obviously that's as timely now as ever. Rule in the name of the people can be accomplished by an oligarchy of Jew bankers hiding behind the scenes, and that's usually what happens. So same problem just about exactly 100 years ago from when I'm reading this in 2020. And that is the end of the short stories of Saki. And I think you'll agree they're very, very good. We're very proud to have them as great literature and think about them and study them in our learning college. So thanks for being with me. And like I said, we're up to about 400 of 600. The last 200 are three so-called novels. In the section of the novels, and why not? We'll go ahead and do them too. We'll take multiple segments to do them. We won't do them in one sitting. But anyway, thanks for being with me for the rest of the stories, and I'll be back with you again for more from Saki real soon.